Pastor Mai, good evening and welcome to this week's episode of Agenda. I'm Ewan Gorn. On the programme tonight, UK medical expert says doctors across are reluctant to prescribe medicinal cannabis despite current laws. Tram lines are laid on the promenade as the scheme to redevelop the entire area inches forward. And we hear from the organisers of the community push in Peel against plans by Empire Garage to redevelop three sites in the old town. Getting doctors to prescribe medicinal cannabis is a problem, according to one UK medical expert, Honorary Professor of Neurology at the University of Newcastle. Mike Barnes says education is needed in the field if the profession is to make use of the country's liberal laws. Professor Barnes, who addressed Tynwald members last week, told the island's politicians that around 80% of doctors are for the medicinal use of the drug in theory. However, in practice, they won't prescribe it because they aren't confident enough. A consultation on the use of medicinal and industrial cannabis closed on the island last month. Well, with that in mind, Aaron Ibanez went and spoke to Professor Barnes.
The law in the UK is now really quite liberal. I've said you can any doctor, any specialist doctor, can prescribe for any condition, which is probably the most liberal in Europe. The problem is getting the doctors to prescribe. Now, some, it's a morality question. They just don't agree with cannabis being legal and just won't prescribe it. But that's actually quite unusual. About 80% of doctors are okay with medical cannabis in theory, but actually in practice they won't prescribe it. And they won't prescribe it because of ignorance. And I don't mean that rudely. It's because of a lack of education. They've never been taught about cannabis. They don't know what to prescribe or how to prescribe it or what dose to use.
And arguably, we're actually seeing in this debate that members of the public are more clued up on it than the doctors.
That's very true. And there's been a very big campaign during 2018, and many of the families, particularly the families of young children with epilepsy, are incredibly knowledgeable about cannabis, do know a lot more than the doctors. I think from the doctor's point of view, many should embrace that and learn from that. There are some, sadly, who probably are rather antagonistic to patients coming in and telling them what to prescribe and how to prescribe it. But yeah, we're in an ironic situation that many members of the public know a lot more about cannabis than most of the doctors.
You talk about an ignorance in the medical community. Do you think that stems from perhaps the taboo surrounding cannabis? And actually broaching that is actually perhaps difficult for doctors to be quite forthcoming when it comes to discussing the subject and perhaps even just engaging in the debate.
I think that's true. Now, after all, for the last 50 plus years, we've had cannabis portrayed to us as bad, anti-establishment, no good for anything, of no medicinal use. And now all of a sudden, the doctors brought up in that tradition have been told, well, actually, for certain conditions, it is quite useful. And I think it does take a little bit of a change of mindset for doctors to get their head around the fact that actually now for some conditions, for some people, it can be quite useful. And I think some doctors, not all, fortunately, but some doctors are very resistant to cannabis for that reason.
And have you engaged in discussions with doctors on the Isle of Man, and perhaps what's the feedback been there?
Yes, I have. I think generally it does seem to be much more acceptable here than it is, I have to generalise, in the UK. I think the medical profession here seems to be more attuned. You know, I haven't taken a survey, so I'm sure there are some people who are very antagonistic to it, and some are very open to it. But I certainly get the feeling that there's more doctors here than in the UK that are willing to prescribe. And what I'd like to see here is the GP population prescribing, that who has been banned in the moment in the UK. It's only hospital specialists that can prescribe in the UK. And I think that, sadly, that takes out half of the medical profession. I mean, why? There's not been any particular groups that know more about cannabis than any other, so why do we exclude half of the profession? I think cannabis is very much a wellness product, a health product, and I think GPs have a very important role to play in prescribing. So if it's introduced here in the Isle of Man, I would love to see it introduced so that all doctors can prescribe, should they wish to.
You talk about an 80% consensus, say, of doctors who are willing to engage, who are quite receptive to this. Yeah. How do you go about educating them then? And what sort of in place, and what are your plans involved with this whole education process?
Well, it wasn't. I think it's a fault of the UK government. They introduced the change of the law, but without introducing at the same time any health education programme for the doctors. So that's been up to, I, for example, have set up an Academy of Medical Cannabis, as it's called, which is 12 free modules, about 20 minutes a module, and that teaches the doctors roughly the basics of cannabis medicine, what to prescribe and how to prescribe it. I'd like to see more of those in different formats. Day seminars, week-long seminars, more detailed courses. I think it's rather sad that it's been up to the individuals or the private sector to establish training programs, when I think it would be nice to have seen more formalized training programs from, for example, Health Education England. So maybe I would like to see in the Isle of Man the health department perhaps working with those like me that have established things already and saying, well, here's a proper program that we can accredit and you should go through this program before you start prescribing. That would be great.
The Isle of Man's just gone through a consultation process that's just recently concluded. Do you think that's a good idea, putting this to public? Do you not think it's open to abuse, or do you not think it should have been left to professionals? Setting policy, perhaps, or directing policy on this?
Yeah, I can see that point. Actually, I think for this is a very interesting social debate, and I think it's perfectly valid to ask the public. After all, we're in a different scenario from a new drug. You wouldn't dream of asking the public to have a sort of say on introducing any new pharmaceutical medicine, but this is not a new pharmaceutical medicine. This has been around for centuries, and a lot of people are using it illegally, and a lot of people know a lot about it. So I think for this particular instance, it's perfectly valid to ask the local population specific questions. Do you support the legalization of cannabis for medical purposes? And I think that will help inform the debate in the Isle of Man, and it'd be really interesting to see the results of that over the next few weeks.
And just a final question, have you seen instances in the medical community where you've got health professionals, GPs, doctors advising patients to obtain medical cannabis illegally for the sake of, you know, a dignified life, or for the sake of perhaps a matter of life and death?
Sadly, yes. And of course, up before the 1st of November, the only way to obtain it was illegal. And I've known many cases, where the doctor said, yes, I would support you doing that. Sadly, you'll have to do it illegally. So the doctor effectively encouraging people to break the law. I know doctors that have said, go to Holland to get this, because it's good quality. GMP, as it's called, good manufacturing practice standard. They've said, go and break the law. And at long last, we've got to the situation where doctors can now prescribe, and they don't have to encourage patients to break the law. And what we now must do is actually get the doctors actually to prescribe by teaching them and helping them over their natural reluctance.
And the Isle of Man, in this entirety of the discussion, where does it sit in relation to the UK? Of course, it does heed the legislation, but is there an opportunity now, in light of this consultation, to start directing itself?
I hope so. I think there's lessons to be learnt, positive lessons from the UK experience in the last few months, and negative lessons to be learnt. And I like to see the Isle of Man mirror the UK legislation, but I like to see two major changes. And one is to allow prescription from all doctors and not just hospital specialists. That opens the pool of knowledge to everyone who may be interested in prescribing. And secondly, at the same time, introduce good quality educational programs so doctors can be educated and feel supported and enabled to prescribe.
Professor of Neurology at the University of Newcastle, Mike Barnes, there speaking to Aaron Ibanez. Well, it's full steam ahead to get Douglas Promenade ready for a number of key milestones this year. The £25 million project is due to be completed by the end of next year. Well, at the end of last week, we heard the first of the horse tram lines have been laid, set to be finished for the season to start in less than 4 weeks. That's the 25th of April. Alex Watton went down to the prom and first of all caught up with the Infrastructure Minister, Ray Harmer.
There's a lot of good feedback that it's finally getting it done and it's happening, and I think everybody's looking forward to its completion in just over, you know, October next year. And obviously we want try and keep disruption to a minimum, and obviously that's going to be difficult, and we just ask, please bear with us, because this is really quite exciting. It's only every 90 years or so, but it's good to see it moving. I think that's the most important thing.
You mentioned how this is one of the big milestones. What other milestones are there?
Well, there'll be other milestones where we release certain areas. So, for example, at the southern end, when we get the before TT and there's some pavement work done, and you'll see whole sections start to be complete. That'll be quite exciting. And also, I think particularly there's milestones in the future around the Culture Centre and that whole area around the Villa Gaiety area. So there's sort of lots of milestones along the way, and actually to see the sort of transformation is going to be something quite special.
What you're mentioning there, milestones by any other name might be deadlines. We've got the horse trams opening in 4 weeks, and of course we've got TT coming up May, June. So is the pressure on there?
Yeah, absolutely this pressure's on, but it's also an exciting project as well. And obviously the aim is, and hope with all the contractors, that everything's delivered on time and on schedule.
Hi, I'm Danny, the site manager for Alderling Construction here. We're just in the process now of placing the rail and drilling and fixing. So hopefully we'll be getting about 100 metres a week in of rail, and the concrete slabs are already down about 500 to 600 metres in front already.
In terms of logistically getting that done, how much disruption will that give? Not much?
Hopefully not too much, because we close the bottom of Summer Hill here to crane it all in, and then we'll be moving it along the slab as we go. So hopefully not too much.
How big a job is it? How many people do you need? How long does it take to do each component?
At the moment, we've probably got about 30 to 40 guys on site. There will be more depending on different areas, but normally averaging about 30 a day. Yeah.
And how do you choose which areas to start on first and what direction to go in?
It's all pre-planned out of different areas. We have to get the rail in down the middle, get that done, finished, and then move the traffic over so we can then get the services in on either side.
So how many metres?
We're putting in 35 metres a day of concrete. Okay. And then we'll be hopefully putting in probably 100 metres of rail a week from then on.
So when does that mean it will be done by?
I'll have to go back and have a proper look at that, the exact dates.
But obviously the opening date's in just about 4 weeks' time, just less. We're all on track for that.
Hopefully, yeah. The guys will be working 7 days a week, probably putting it in.
This has a high level of scrutiny. Are you feeling the pressure?
Some days, but every job has its pressures.
Infrastructure Minister Ray Harmer. Alden Construction is the contractor undertaking works on the prom. Their site manager, Danny, says they'll be working 7 days a week to get it done on time.
Tiger Mahoney, Civil Engineering Director of Alden Construction. It's a relief they've got this far. It's been a tough start. It's gone well, but you always like to see some of the finished work going down. Yeah, the horse tram tracks will be the first item that the public will see when it's finally complete going down. So it's a red letter day for us.
And in terms of schedule, we're on time to open for the season?
Yes, Isle of Man Railways are opening the horse tram on the 25th of April, which is only 4 weeks away, so we're on target for that.
It's had high level of scrutiny, obviously, from public and media alike, of the placing of the horse trams as well. Now, they are in the centre of the road where they were before. Is that a reassurance you want to sort of put out there?
It's what the planners wanted. It's what everyone wanted. As you know, they were originally going to go partly on the promenade walkway, and the decision was made that wasn't agreed by the planners, so they're going back where they were always going, where they originally were, until we get down past the War Memorial, when a single line then continues up close to the curb line as far as the sea terminal.
Another sort of part of the ongoing works is that, of course, you're going to be working in several places at once. This is just one aspect of the regeneration works. How many people are working on this at any one time?
In terms of site management, we have about 10. In terms of operatives on the ground, we have about a minimum of 30. And as we progress, that will continue to grow as there's more work going on. We've always got to work in about three or four, to make the programme work in the 2-year timescale we've allowed ourselves. We need to work in about three or four places at once. So as more work opens up, we'll have more and more people on site.
And are the majority of these people local workers?
The vast majority are local. We're a local company, Alden, although I'm obviously not, but I've been over 24 years now. But we took the decision at tender stage we were going to work with local contractors to assist us and to keep as much of the work on the island as possible. So currently we're working with Island Drainage and Groundworks, Stephen Christian and Sons, Watling Street Works, Kevin Henry Construction, all of which are local, all of which employ local labour, paying local taxes.
While joining Minister Harmer and others on the promenade, the Chief Minister, Howard Quayle, was also there.
Walking along it now, you can see why we've had problems for so long with the promenade. For example, if you look here, you can clearly see that the steel that the concrete was poured in is the concrete's on top of the steel. And therefore, that's not going to strengthen concrete. When you lay concrete, if you're putting mesh in, you've got to have spacers put in it so that it raises the steel into the concrete, so it strengthens the concrete. And you can clearly see here that all the steel is underneath the concrete, which won't have given it much support. So, yeah, the job seems to be good. Obviously, it's a big project, and I know there are, you know, people living on the promenade who are unhappy with the work going on. It's going to be over 2 years. However, we've got, you know, the promenade has been a mess now for a while. We've got to get it right, and I'm glad that it started. And let's hope in the end of 2020 we'll be able to look at this and say, yes, it was well worth it.
Obviously, as you were saying, it's a chance for you to have an update on what's going on. When you do dig down, though, there were usually surprises. Are there any concerns or anything that's popped up?
Unexpected? I'm told so far, not here, but maybe further down where they've got to dig considerably deeper for some of the drains that go under. I know in between the Castle Mona and the Imperial, for example, I've got a painting which shows a stream and a pond in between before the promenade was built. So that amount of water, there will be big pipes taking that away. So they may well have to go fairly deep there to sort that out. But so far, I don't think they've found no skeletons, that's for sure.
And you're reassured in terms of scheduling and, you know, obviously the pressure's on at the moment, that everything's going on on time?
Well, I don't think it's on time. I've been told that there are delays, but hopefully they'll catch up during the project. But the quality of the work that I've seen so far, as someone who has in his time laid a fair bit of concrete, I am pleased with the quality of the work so far.
I suppose on time, I also mean by in time for the horse trams to run, of course, in 4 weeks.
Yes, well, I think the horse trams, I'm told, will be running in 4 weeks' time. However, it's not going to be, obviously, the full length of the promenade. It'll be a short run, but run they will.
The Chief Minister, Howard Quayle. You're listening to Agenda on Manx Radio. The organisers of a Peel residents' meeting to object to plans, which some have branded completely overwhelming, said they will work to see the application turned down. It comes after the applications lodged by Empire Garage. It comes after plans were lodged by Empire Garage to demolish buildings at three sites in the old town and replace them with apartment blocks and new homes. Over 100 people gathered at the Masonic Hall at a meeting organised by members of the local community last month to discuss their objections. Well, I spoke to Sarah and Andrew Johnson after that meeting. They arranged it and will be coordinating community efforts to object to these plans. I asked them why they decided to take on this issue.
Well, it happened this way. Basically, we heard about the publication of the plans on Friday evening, just gone, and as a result of that, we contacted just our immediate neighbours, and we had about 12 or 14 people come round into our living room. We looked at the plans, we talked about what the implications were, and we realised that between us we had a certain number of skills that we could bring to this, with people sort of knowing a little bit about housing, people knowing a bit about conservation. One of our neighbours is a builder who raised some really, really helpful points about the potential dangers of this massive excavation and so on. And we just thought that here was an opportunity to try and, because we know so many people in the community, there really is a community, particularly on Stanley Road. Everybody knows someone, you know, we're in and out of each other's doors. It's not just our immediate neighbours, you know, sometimes it's someone else a few streets away.
And this would just cut us off from all those people. So, as Andy said, when we heard about it, I was at home, so I went running down the road, knocking on as many doors as possible, and we had a lot of those Edvard Munch faces, the final sort of big scream. And so, as Andy said again, people came to the house, and it's just been really quite an amazing experience to just see the depth of feeling And the help people need as well, because people actually don't know what to do about writing a planning objection. And that's the biggest issue here, because obviously people want to object, but they want to do it factually, they want to do it relevantly, but they need to do it in accordance with policy to actually be heard and for it to be effective. So from there, we decided we probably ought to call a meeting, because we have a big front room, but not big enough for everybody that wanted to come along and do
80
this.
People this evening or something like that. Fantastic.
It's just overwhelming. And, you know, obviously word got out. So if we've done that between Friday and what day are we today?
Wednesday.
We've done that between Friday and Wednesday. That's pretty amazing. And it was also fantastic tonight to have the commissioners, some of the commissioners here in an MHK and MLK, you know, and that just hopefully shows that, you know, this is every level and everybody taking an interest in what's going on, and we'll just have to see where this goes now, won't we?
I know you've done the sort of how to planning for people who've gathered here tonight, but just what are the issues that you see with the planning application? Because there are more than just the amenity, there are several layers to this.
There are several layers. I think I come at it, obviously I've got a professional background in this kind of thing, but it's very much with a sort of conservation and historical approach. But you know, we're aware that of course we've got an existing business that some might say is sort of inappropriate to the area, although having said that, you know, many of us cherish having a local garage that we can take our vehicles to. You know, it's quite an important part of any functioning community. But you know, if those buildings or that business is coming to the end of its life, then of course there's opportunity to change things. Really, what we're saying is that what's proposed is just so overwhelming and of such enormous scale that it's inappropriate to the area. It'll look wrong visually, and the effects afterwards of this sort of scale of development is that sort of community that we've talked about is actually going to be physically broken up with all these high walls and physical barriers between us.
If that's the case, though, won't the planning officials realise that? But you did reference that perhaps some of the drawings have been a bit misleading.
This is one of the biggest issues that we had with it when we actually went into the detail with architects and builders alike, and Andy, who obviously studies plans for his planning work he does with Manx National Heritage. I was absolutely stunned to see that the beautiful montages, superimposed montages that they showed were, when I say almost a story too high, they were in some instances 2 and 3 metres too short on height. So the visual impact, already it looked really bad, but if you take the architect's drawings, they are way worse than they're even showing. And I was really upset because that was so misleading. Now, if you don't actually know about that and look at the detail and take time to actually go into that detail, you could easily have missed that and thought, actually, this is a really lovely and appropriate scheme. That is why we did our own visual montages. And the sounds from the audience tonight, to me,
It said it all,
just the gasp of no, you know, seriously, this is just so inappropriate for Peel. We're not adverse to building, you know, to be fair, I don't think any of us actually are. We all agree that it would be lovely to put something on the site, but just not this magnitude and scale, and the height is just awful.
And the lack of prior consultation to the publisher of the plans also seems to have left a bad taste, would that be fair to say?
Yeah.
I think that is fair to say. You know, the planners have become a lot more human in recent years. You know, thankfully with the existence of the internet and so on, and the presence of the planning division on the government website, there's lots and lots of advice in there. And one of the things that they make really clear when you're making the decision to put in a planning application is to think about the effect on your neighbours and to consult with them. And this hasn't happened.
The biggest issue for that one really was the people on Christian Street and Stanley Road, and we are included in that, which obviously is why we do have a very personal interest in this. The scale of the buildings and the proximity of the buildings and how it obliterates absolutely everything in front of us is beyond anything we could have imagined proposed for that site. You know, had it been, say, houses, there was a lovely comment from a member in the audience tonight, Sue, who suggested, you know, family housing and gardens. It's something we're very short of in Peel, and something true to my heart. You know, what about elderly bungalows and gardens and just some highs and lows, you know, like Andy talked about in terms of keeping in with the vernacular of the place and what keeps the charm, keeps some vistas, you know, and some views through. You know, that is another thing that everybody is so upset about, is that all of the major roads into Peel that take you down to the prom and they give you those gorgeous little peaks of the bay and the sea and then that glorious castle, they are just going to be obliterated. You won't even know they're there until you get onto the prom, and then it's like, oh gosh, didn't know that was there. You know, this is the joy of Peel at the moment.
In that respect, you know, in my day job, I've lost track of the number of coach parties that I've taken down Stanley Road where that the big reveal is apparent sort of partway down with the castle in the background, and that simply is going to be lost. And you know, when we talk about our visitor economy and we talk about what it is about what makes the island different for people, when they come here and when they see the amazing scenery that we have and the amazing characterful settlements that we have, and so on, these are assets that we need to
preserve.
We need to, you know, really cherish those, and they're going to be lost.
Sarah and Andrew Johnson there. Well, that's all from tonight's programme. We'll be back with more from Agenda next week, and you can listen again to this episode online as a podcast. But for now, Gurumayu, and have a good evening.